Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, permanently archived. Today we'll resume with chapters 21 and 22, our penultimate session of Mike Smith's The Eradicator from 2024, a new novel. Again, 21 and 22. Chapter 21 of The Eradicator is called Chapter 21, Real Army Soldier. Seated in a chair in Hotel Golda lobby, Chad kept a watch. He saw many people hustle in and out, few lingering. When he spotted Noah, he lifted the newspaper higher so that it covered his face. He peered over it to see Noah entering the elevator. He could see that Noah was going to the suite. He put down the newspaper and left the hotel. He walked toward the Elie Wiesel Medical Research Center. Partway there, he ducked into a taxi. The taxi brought him to a block adjacent to the center. He got out and approached the place, a modernistic building with two small windowless entrance doors and three stories. No one noticed him taking in the night air. It was 10 o'clock and the streets buzzed with only slightly less traffic than during the day. Flip on to 166. Pretty short, these two chapters, only about 10 pages. He spotted two soldiers in full camo doing guard duty. They were walking around the building in turn, each carrying an M27 rifle. That was unusual. On previous reconnaissance, he had spotted no guard. He approached the soldier now, standing by the entrance. Got a light? The soldier, a dumpy younger man, saw Chad's prosthetic limbs and understood that he was a veteran. He stepped toward Chad, who stood in a darker area, and gave him a light, flicking the lighter a brief snap. A cigarette hanging from his mouth, Chad stepped closer and crushed the soldier's insoles. He twisted the soldier's neck and felt this, and the soldier fell against his body. He walked this dead weight to a kind of alcove around the corner. A few minutes later, the other soldier on duty returned from his round to relieve his comrade and take up position. He didn't look closely enough at the profile of the stationary uniformed man as he approached him. He did wonder why his comrade stood in a dark patch some ways from the entrance. He understood nothing when the uniformed man garroted him. So now, Chad has just killed two guards. In the first soldier's uniform and carrying his rifle and security pass, Chad left the second soldier's body on the sidewalk and entered the building. He saw no one in the long, brightly lit hall that served as the ground floor lobby. He spied two small cameras in the ceiling. He didn't shoot them. Instead, he let go in all directions, the rifle blazing almost to the point of becoming incandescent. He shot up the walls, the unmanned reception desk, one of the elevator doors. He knew that the cameras were registering all this. When he spent the rifle, he moved to a door not far from the reception desk and shot off its knob with his .44. The door opened onto a service room about 6 by 6 feet. He changed back into his own clothes, folded the soldier's uniform, and then placed the rifle on top of it. He left the room and found an elevator. He shot a few bullets into the elevator panel. That disabled the elevator. He climbed through the escape door in the ceiling. He skinned up the cable to the third floor, his good hand sometimes slipping on the grease of the cable. He made it to the third floor door and applied enough lateral pressure to get it to open. He knew that Jake worked on the third floor because Jake had told him so. He didn't hear anything in the elevator shaft, but he knew that his shooting must have attracted attention and that the whole building would go into lockdown soon. He stuck his grease-covered hand in his pocket to hide it. Tava stood nervously by the unmanned reception desk on the third floor. She usually worked late, depending on the project. She had bolted out of her work area when she heard the shots. Now she saw a man approaching her. He had a strange gait and a prosthetic arm and a leg. "I heard shooting. What's going on?" Chad asked in the most concerned-sounding voice he could muster. "Who are you?" Tava barked. "I'm Dr. Gurion's husband. I'm worried about him because he didn't come home on time. Where is he?" "He isn't Dr. Gurion." Tava decided to call security and went for a button on the desk. The sight of Chad pulling his .44 stopped her, but only for a moment. She ignored the gun and went for the button again, only to feel a breaking pain along her back and her right arm. Chad had twisted her arm behind her back. He pressed the muzzle of the .44 against her head. "Take me to him." She didn't move until he twisted her arm even further. Resisting every step of the way, she led him to what looked like a service room door. When he relaxed his hold on her for a second in order to try the knob, she jerked herself away. He twisted her neck. Like the first soldier on guard, she fell quietly. He had to shoot the knob off this door, too. He burst into a dark room. Finding the light switch, he turned on the light to see Jake lying on the floor unconscious. He checked the body. A black eye. Bruises, cuts, still bleeding, left arm broken, above the elbow, torture. And they left him here, to die, no, to rest, then suffer more of the same whenever they returned. Chad could stabilize the arm and treat the other wounds. There was no need for a hospital visit, but how to get him out? He could carry Jake, but that would be conspicuous. He looked around. He looked out in the hall, glanced in the other rooms. He found a sample card and, carefully removing the rack of test tubes and other junk from it, he wheeled it back to Jake. He lay Jake on his back on top of the cart and then wheeled the cart out of the room with its new cargo and wheeled it down the hall. He had to go fast now. He knew that the cameras on this floor were filming him all doing this. He couldn't help that. As people began appearing at the ends of the hallways, he got the cart into a service elevator and hit the button for the first floor. As the service elevator descended quickly, he reloaded his .44. In what seemed like no time, the large door opened. It was time to fight. Pushing the cart down the hall and toward the main entrance doors as fast as he could run, he shot two security personnel in his way. A soldier who managed to shoot and graze his good arm, and some other open-mouthed person pulling a gun or trying to. A woman didn't know which way to jump, but finally made a decision and avoided being run over. Chad blew through the entrance and skidded off the sidewalk. There, police vehicles and a crowd had gathered. He collided with some police officers in the strobing glare of light bars and camera lights. "They're shooting!" he was crying out. He had tucked his .44 away in the confusion of the collision. "How many?" an officer asked him. "I think one shooter, maybe more." "Victims? Victims? 20, 30, I don't know, he's hurt," Chad indicated Jake. Several people gathered to look at Jake. Chad was shouting, "No, don't film him, help him, help the others." With assistance from some of the crowd, he found a taxi and placed Jake's body in the back seat. No one questioned him, no one stopped him. He gave a command to the driver, and the taxi took off. It moved quietly through the streets. The driver said nothing. Chad saw the hotel rear up in the windshield. He hated this one more than anything, but it had to be done. He punched the driver's head, knocking him out, and took the wheel. He veered into a side street, stopped, and then wiped the blood from Jake's wounds. To the hotel entrance, he carried Jake over his shoulder. Just before he entered the lobby, he stuck in Jake's mouth one of the cigarettes from the pack he had bought earlier today. "How much is too much, right?" he said to a passing guest, implying, he hoped, that he was carrying a drunken friend. Poker-faced, he stepped into an elevator which had no people in it and touched the button for their floor. He got Jake into the suite, shaking for the first time after the key worked and the door opened. He turned on a light and placed Jake on a sofa in the common area. He washed his hands, made a tourniquet just in case, put the arm in a tight sling. It turned out that he didn't need the tourniquet because there was no arterial bleeding. Then he tried to revive Jake. He threw cold water in his face, saying, "Come on, TL, come on, come on." Jake moved his head. Evidently, the sling awakened him already, but he could only move now. Chad used hot water, face towels, and bar soap to clean the wounds. Jake shook, so Chad threw one of his comforters over him. That would have to do for now. Jake surprised him by saying, "Where are we? I didn't tell them anything." Chad said they were in the hotel. "We can't let them come back. Can't let them come back," Jake struggled to get up. "They won't come here, sir." Jake managed to get into a sitting position. They will. You have to leave. I never abandoned a brother. Jake raised an eyebrow and said with labored humor, not even a brother-in-law? Can't move you anymore, sir. You have to recover here. Jake sank back, shaking his head in disapproval. Chad went on, I thought about it. We have to retreat tomorrow if you're improved. In my judgment, sir, we can't attack them. We can only retreat and hope their bad plans fail with God's help. Jake was nodding now and said in a choked voice, okay, but never believe we're in God's mind. God is something in our brains. It only means our ability to order sense data usefully. Okay, but never believe we're in God's mind. God is something in our brains. It only means our ability to order sense data usefully. What Jake said worried Chad. It sounded like the nonsense that a traumatized person might babble. He put a cold hand towel on Jake's forehead. Get some rest, sir. Let me know before you try to walk. He slept on the other sofa. He lay there for 30 minutes before it occurred to him to treat his own flesh wound in his good arm, which he did with the same professionalism he had shown in saving Jake's life. That's the end of chapter 21. Chapter 22, An Eye for an Eye. Chapter 22, An Eye for an Eye. Jake saw the digital clock on the table, 3:12 a.m. He got up to tend himself. His broken arm hurt him most. Easing himself back on the sofa took some time. He lay there thinking. All his life he wanted to be noble, not common. He, the beneficiary of Chad's noble actions, had always brooded about what nobility is. He used to have a clear definition of modern nobility. He thought it meant scientists. The principal value of modernity was progress. So scientists weren't, in quotes, progress in quotes. The principal value of modernity was, quote, progress, unquote. So scientists were today's true royalty. He had never questioned that idea. Nor did he question that the best scientists worked for the system. He had always identified the top authorities with civilization itself. Now he rejected those ideas. He saw what they led to, the evil of great ape integration. Clearly, technocratic values had no moral content. But worse, GAI would lead to a world beyond good and evil. Apes had no conception of free will, so replacing humans with them would not only replace civilization with jungle, but replace morality with it. GAI threatened the existence of meaning itself by threatening the existence of humans. And he had made the decisive contribution to GAI. They took his research, remember. Blood-soaked nihilism was his career accomplishment. Working for the system in spite of himself. His mind was moving slowly. He asked himself, wouldn't nobility, true nobility, consist in correcting my mistakes? Yes, and I already know how. Defeat the cabal at the center. Defeat the bioweapon. Defeat them. This was a tall order, but he had already begun the work. He just had to figure out how to get back into the center and finish it. He hadn't told Chad or anyone else what his true work was. It wasn't to pacify great apes. He intended to turn the Jews' bioweapon back on them and wipe them out. It was self-defense. He had considered the idea that humans ought to defend themselves, but he found that historically they had always failed. They ended up pushing the Jews. He had considered the idea that humans ought to defend themselves, but he found that historically they had always failed. They ended up pushing the Jews from one place to another. The Jews always returned. No, humanity couldn't defend itself effectively. He had to defend it. Because he could. He needed only to change a few parameters in the bioweapon. He had already made good progress toward flipping it, photonegative style. His repurposed bioweapon would target the Jews instead of the non-Jews. Nor would it rely on germ theory alone. It would also kill with what he called contact at a distance, similar to action at a distance in physics. He counted on the eusociality of Jews, so like that of termites. Although any mechanism by itself would be effective, smallpox, contact at a distance, spike proteins, his altered bioweapon would use them all. It would overdetermine the outcome. Would it get out of control and kill half the planet? Out of control, no. Kill the planet? That depended. Who knew how much of the Yudisha tupus lurked in the genes of the various nations? The Jewish typhus. The repurposed bioweapon would spread like wildfire if he could finish it. He was ready to sacrifice his life to return to the center and do that. He considered his life forfeit for three reasons. First, he bore the permanent guilt of supporting GAI. Second, if successful, he would be the author of the genocide of the Jews. He believed that losing his life over that was inevitable in the nature of things. He must die for killing people. Third, he had to throw the cabal off Chad's trail. He would leave for the center without Chad, giving him a chance to retreat unburdened. Chad was the good man who might have a family in the future. His own future had been foreclosed. He had only one use now, to do his duty and make reparation to the countless people he had harmed, to genocide the genociders. He had only one use now, to do his duty and make reparation to the countless people he had harmed, to genocide the genociders. He got up, unsteady on his feet. He found a piece of paper and a pen. Taking almost 5 minutes to scrawl it, he left this note on Chad's chest. This is an order. Leave Israel immediately. He slipped from the room and used one hand to crab button his shirt in the hall. He found the elevator and descended. The pre-dawn light streaked the lobby windows. He squinted only a little. The glass entrance doors opened automatically, and he was standing 15 feet away from Noah and his taxi. Behind the taxi was another vehicle, a Shin Bet personnel vehicle. Immediately, three Shin Bet agents and Noah surrounded him. Noah? Jake said. Noah nodded to the other agents and took Jake's arms. Please come with us, one of the agents insisted. They put him in the taxi with two agents on either side of him. Noah slid into the driver's seat and closed the door. Mr. McAllister, said Noah, we want to help you. Jake said nothing. Let me explain. We oppose great ape integration. We want to stop it. Your plan for pacifying great apes interests us. We want to help you progress it. That is what you're working on, right? You told them, Jake said in a low voice. You told the center that I'm interested in the pacification of apes. Noah turned from the rearview mirror and looked at Jake directly. Not me. It leaked, said the Shin Bet agent sitting to Jake's left. The agent on his right added, the leaker is dead. Noah already put the taxi in gear and moved them into traffic. He explained in a kind of monologue, Israel's divided. Not for the first time. You see, even though Israel didn't take in great apes, integrating them into other societies destroys civilization. It hurts the economies of the whole world, and it unleashes harm on innocent people. No Jew who is a Jew can stand for that. We understand that you provided the research behind the great ape integration programs. We know that you must regret it. You must wish to atone for what you have done. I'm sure you agree it's morally mandatory to help us for these reasons. Jake raised an eyebrow. Why did you torture me? That wasn't us, said one of the other agents. It was the other faction, the faction of insane Jews, Noah said grimly. They really believe their mission is to harm other peoples. They are what is called Zionists. You've heard that term, yes? Zionists are Nazis, nothing but Nazis. We stand for the healing mission of the world, not harming it. That is the true Jewish mission. It was perverted by racists and supremacists who unfortunately remain in significant numbers among our people, the unreconstructed elements. They give Israel a bad name, and all diaspora Jews, said the other agent. They lack compassion, Noah said. They're mostly genocidalists. The Torah Council's embracing the other and working with him for a better world, which... He stopped and said curtly, I'm boring you. You are not a Jew. No, Jake said, but I'm glad there are some Jews like you who understand. Do you know about the bioweapon? Noah's ears pricked up. The bioweapon? Jake nodded. The center has finished a bioweapon which will kill all non-Jews. Yes, we have heard of it. We could stop it as well as pacify apes. But your work is pacifying apes. Biological weapons are not your specialty. Jake said nothing. Or maybe I'm wrong? Noah asked. No, Jake said, as if confessing disappointment at himself. You aren't wrong. They aren't my specialty. You'll have to find someone else to tackle that problem. We will, said the other agent. We have the resources, Noah said. Jake asked, but how would I complete my work? I would need access to the center's equipment. What precisely do you intend to do? How are apes pacified? Noah asked. Jake explained. He said that an RNA vaccine would render the great apes, bonobos, chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans, docile. They become like domestic pets, even more manageable, actually. The vaccine could be added to their food supplies if there's any resistance to taking it. We would need agents doing that, Noah said, nodding thoughtfully. Could even be added to human food supplies, Jake went on. Spike proteins would do the rest, only slower. You think like a genocidalist, Noah joked. The other agents laughed, but a good one, Noah said, a reverse genocidalist. Reversing genocide is what I want to do, Jake said. They pulled up a block from the center. You haven't said how we get in there, said Jake. We control it now. You do? We took control after the shooting. Your lover is talented. Jake said nothing to that. Noah turned around and looked at him. You must feel proud of him for saving your life. If you control the center, Jake asked, that means we can go in and I can work? Noah nodded yes and silently signaled to the other agents. The personnel carrier pulled up behind the taxi just now and parked. Six agents got out of it. The sun began to break on the tops of the buildings. 10 advanced toward the center's entrance. Jake, Noah, and 8 agents. And that's the end of chapter 22. So, one more session to go. Chapters 23 and 24 are going ahead. But I've been Alex Linder reading to you out of The Eradicator by Mike Smith. This was chapters 21 and 22, all permanently archived at vnnforum.com. And you can read this novel at Mike Smith's Substack, which you can find online. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be with you again real soon for the final session.